Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
It's The Wonky Show. Jackie Smith says there's no new money, but is it a bluff? We'll dissect the remarks. Plus, UKVI is cracking down on attendance, and there's intel on student hardship. It's all coming up.
And so I can travel around as many European countries as I like. But the reality remains the fiscal inheritance that we have as a government, and that will be the starting point on which we'll be developing our reforms.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to get across the week's developments, as usual, three top flight guests. In Preston, Ben Volume is Executive Director at the Association of Heads of University Administration. That's a hewer to you and me. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
It has to be finalising the agenda for the AHUA conference, which we're going to open for registration imminently, with all the big names, and including some up-and-coming guy called Jim Dickinson.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, very much looking forward to it. In central Bedfordshire, Danny Paley, Senior Researcher at the Social Market Foundation. Danny, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I'm actually in the middle of moving a house, so my highlight this week was preparing for the podcast and doing something that wasn't packing boxes or thinking about how in the world we're going to move our family of 14 humans, cats, ducks and chickens.
How many layers of like newspaper you need to put on stuff to stop it breaking? Yeah, all of that. And in Norfolk this week, Michael Salmon is News Editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Jim. Hi, everyone. I think my highlight has been watching lots of old Wallace and Gromit shows with my son, which has been very nice. Every day he's come back after school, we've watched one. They're not quite as good as I remember, but there's some plot holes. But still, it's been nice.
Excellent. So, yes, we start this week with Jackie Smith, Minister of State for Skills and Government, helped launch a pamphlet this week, and she was notably called on extra money, Michael.
Yeah, I think we're going to now have quite a few months until the spending review in June, where everybody is sort of hoping, reading the runes, will the government sort of come to the rescue of the sector? Although I'm not sure there's too much cause for optimism, but still, we're going to be in this period for a while now. So it's always newsworthy when a minister is, put the question. And Jackie Smith's comments at this King's Policy Institute event this week were not particularly reassuring. As you said, she said that, there won't be a large injection of public money. She was asked sort of specifically about this balance between, students contributing to the cost of HE and the public, the taxpayer, if you like, contributing. And, she was sort of really quite clear that, they didn't see this sort of rebalancing of who contributes. Is it students that pay or is it the taxpayer that pays? She said, for her, it's unlikely to happen. Obviously, we've still got this whole framing of, we have no plans, we'll set out our plans in the summer, et cetera, et cetera. But she was still just stressing this whole issue about, what we need to really see is strong sector collaboration and much more effective spending by universities, i.e., the total amount of money is probably going to be something similar to what it is now. Potentially there'll be, another inflation-linked tuition fee rise. That's sort of quite heavily rumoured, expected at this point. But the total envelope, if you like, is going to be pretty similar. And anybody who's thinking that, this is the moment where Labour sort of rebalances how much the state puts in to support higher education, given all the benefits that the public purse gets from higher education, is feels likely to be disappointed, I think.
Yes. Now, and she also referenced Europe. Here's a clip.
Different countries will be coming at this from a different approach to the balance of funding for their higher education systems. And we are undertaking at the moment considerable thought and will come forward in the summer with our broader reform program, the sort of key pillars of which I touched on in my contribution. And we do recognise that what we've done with increasing tuition fees this year is a one-year solution, and there will need to be a longer-term solution there. And it is already, of course, the case that whilst we do have a high proportion of contribution from students, students repaid through the loan repayment system. There is some central government resource that goes into the higher education sector. It is not in the current financial situation likely to be, it will not be the case that there will be a sort of enormous transferring of the funding of higher education from the current student contribution system to a taxpayer funded system. And so I can travel around as many European countries as I like, but the reality remains the fiscal inheritance that we have as a government, and that will be the starting point on which we'll be developing our reforms.
Now, Ben, presumably no minister at this end of the spending review, unless they're keen to get sacked, wanders around their sector and says, well, I'm fighting for more money, or says, unless you wear streeting, presumably, or says, well, hopefully I'll get more money. Or presumably no minister at this point says, we're definitely going to get new money. So this is not a surprise, is it?
No, it's not a surprise. I think the message, is, as Michael says, is very clear and kind of constant, that there's nothing to play with until growth arrives, and growth feels like it's quite a long way off. I think there is some encouragement to think creatively about how we could cut the purse differently, so reallocating the spending in different ways, between different modes, between different institutions, God knows what that means. And I think that's an opportunity for the sector to think about is how would we spend the total allocation in a different and a better way. And I think the other thing, and again, Michael touched on this, is that I hope there is a growing recognition that the inflation link that has been established this year for the first time in a long, long time needs to kind of become part of the perpetual architecture of the funding of this system. The reality is there's been a total of a 6% increase in a 13-year period, where salaries and heating and power and toilet roll costs have all dramatically increased. And so that has forced this continual culture of having to erode a little bit more in order to make the sums add up. We've got to unlock that moving forward.
Yes, I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting, Dani, was, so obviously she was at David Willetts' pamphlet launch, and Willetts was talking about austerity and said, one of the ways they'd kind of cope with that effectively was to shift the balance to graduates. But of course, in doing so, there's a debate, isn't there, between whether the fixed envelope is outlay, how much people sort of get in their pockets, both students and universities, or whether the fixed envelope is eventual return to the Treasury. And it wasn't really clear which of the two she was talking about.
It's difficult. I think that there is still a lot of unanswered questions within government themselves. And I think we aren't expecting at this point that Smith or Phillipson know exactly what they kind of plan to do with HE funding. I think it's obviously difficult for the sector to hear, we don't think there'll be more money coming. It has been a consistent message now for a few months. But it does in some ways make sense. I went to an event about HE funding about a year ago, and there was an audience question asking the panel, if you were in DfE, where would you put any additional money if there was some? Would you put it in early years, schools, FE or HE? And the difficulty is the academic evidence says if you want the most return for your investment, you put it in as early as possible, so early years. Schools make sense because almost everyone attends a school, but not everyone attends the early years setting or goes to university. And then you have FE, which has seen the biggest cut in the education system since 2009. So making that argument for universities over other parts of the education system where money is limited is really difficult. I think also, where whoever pays, whether we're thinking about student contribution or whether we're thinking about state contribution, I don't think that the sector has yet won the argument that the money they have is not sufficient right now. It's true that it's less than it was, right? 6% in 13 years. It's true that causes and kind of an erosion of provision, but whether it is not possible to deliver a good HE system on that amount, I think hasn't yet been established. And I think those in government, civil servants, etc., are not yet fully convinced on that argument.
Mm. I mean, one of the things about this, Michael, she gave obviously the, as Dani says, the efficiency push. But, this reminds me of all those debates about, hospitals, where there is obviously, both in theory and in visceral practice, a difference between the goals that you have when you're trying to save money and be more efficient, and then the goals the government has on widening access, subject availability, the distribution of subject availability. These two aren't necessarily compatible, are they?
Definitely not. I think the issue, though, is we don't actually really know what the government's goals are on some some of those things, like, you know, place and subject spread and widening access. I mean, we sort of intuit them from the opportunity mission and from sort of, you know, ministers mentioning the, you know, UCAS application rate in Barrow Inverness repeatedly. And, you know, we sort of think, okay, you know, Labour has a real regional WP agenda. You know, Labour will be really keen to, you know, in sort of ensure that students who, you know, typically have missed out or to sort of avoid all that stuff Keir Starmer's talked about in speeches about, you know, sort of aspiration for, you know, kids like him to be put off from going up to university. They want to avoid all that. But, you know, we don't actually have that in terms of concrete policy goals. You know, what are the sort of numbers that they want to see? What do they think about different places cutting back on different types of provision? And we probably won't get those things to the summer. The broader point is totally right. You know, efficiency, so, you know, some kinds of efficiency, you know, it'll be interesting, I think, to see what comes out of the University's UK task force on this. You know, there clearly are ways to just sort of make savings about operating costs and, you know, shared procurement and shared services. You know, they're difficult and there's lots of, at the moment, legal and, you know, sort of fiscal barriers to them. But this kind of stuff obviously does not need to be in conflict with a sort of mission. But, you know, if it's about closing courses that aren't recruiting well, you know, rationalizing portfolios, all that kind of stuff, then obviously that is going to damage the sort of subject spread. Potentially it's going to damage, you know, this stuff the British Academy has been working on about, you know, the cold spots, especially for students who are not going to higher tariff universities. These things are all inevitable if what you mean by efficiency is actually around sort of, you know, bits of the HE tree getting lopped off here and there.
Jim, can I add to that? I mean, I think Danny explained rather beautifully the kind of social and economic pressures on the government when it thinks about, you know, the entire economy of and funding distribution for all of its priorities right across the UK. But what we're then left with, so if we recognise that perhaps UK universities, back when we jumped to 9k a year, you know, rightly or wrongly creating that system, that's the system we've got, we started to invest in increasingly complex, large, beautiful, you know, world-class institutions with bigger libraries and better staff student ratios and free gym passes and better lab equipment and, you know, higher spec computers and better Wi-Fi and then as the value of that 9k erodes, we're now left with some potentially really difficult decisions that I think, you know, there are multiple stakeholders in making those decisions about: are we willing to get rid of the free gym pass? Are we willing to downsize the library and change the amount of hours it's open? Are we willing to get rid of the subsidized schools and school dinners, meals for those students who can't afford it? Are we willing to get rid of some of the investment into some of those social and ethical choices we make, like investing money in EDI and estates and so on and so on and so on? And you know, there are difficult decisions to be made there. And I think it's important we're honest about that we can't just keep, you know, salami slicing without things being noticed, or just collaborate to solve the problem overnight and it's fixed. There are probably some choices that will have possibly some adverse impact on students and on the staff that we're responsible for and the communities that we serve.
But this is fascinating to me, Danny, right? Because obviously one of the other things that we got this week was the actual formal statutory instrument that kind of puts the fee increase and the maintenance increase and you know, some of the bits that hadn't been announced yet, like value of postgraduate loans, all kind of formally announced. I mean, in the impact assessment, obviously DfE knows quite a bit about the kind of money end, but then when it was reflecting in the impact assessment on the experience end, what will actually happen as a result of, and what's been happening as a result of, universities having kind of less money in real terms, it was forced to rely on that UCU, Queen Mary University of London, UCU webpage on the number of places going into redundancy. You know, DfE can't even rely on OFS to work out the sort of impacts that this is having at an institutional level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is really difficult. And I think it's an example of one example where, you know, government sets out, makes a decision or sets out a priority and then leaves the sector to kind of figure out how they're actually going to manage with it. And that's the same across lots of different sectors. I don't think that's not kind of unique to HE, although I know the sector often feels kind of forgotten about. And I think, you know, the OFS has said we're going to focus on financial sustainability and we're going to stop all manner of other types of activity to rebalance the sector and to stabilize it. But there's still an open question about whether they have the capacity to do even that. And that's not a kind of a judgment on the OFS and the people that works at, but, you know, they're facing a huge challenge across the sector, a very diverse sector, lots of different providers who are facing different types of challenges and don't seem to have kind of that adequate intel data that's up to date enough to be figuring out where the biggest issues are and who's in the most trouble. So it is really difficult. And then when you do identify kind of areas that need to be looked into, actually fixing those is even more difficult. I mean, I was thinking on efficient spending. We've heard that a lot over the last couple of months. But there's very little sign from kind of government or DfE or the OFS on what kind of spend they actually think is inefficient or ineffective. So identifying types of spend is kind of one hurdle. And, you know, at the SMF, we've been looking at the student premium funding that's given out by OFS. Richard Carr wrote for UK Day One about abolishing the REF. But I just think surely it has to be someone's job somewhere in the DfE or the OFS to help the sector identify, you know, the kind of money that government is talking about that they kind of deem to not be the most efficient use. And then when you've identified a pot, actually liberating it to be used for other purposes is not, you know, immediate or easy. If, you know, for example, the student premium, if changes were made to that, that requires complex negotiation between DfE and the Treasury. So these things are not always in kind of an individual institution's control. The things that are in their control, things like extra kind of student hardship money or library opening times, etc., are the types of savings that will have the biggest impact on the student experience themselves, probably.
Yeah, and Michael, it seems to me that there's a kind of both short-term and medium-term predictability problem here for applicants, because, you know, either you make a load of changes and sort of know that to some extent you'll be vaguely or directly, but hopefully without lots of complaints, breaching your terms and conditions, or you're really vague about what you're offering. In order that, you know, what you say on an open day today can just about hold in 2 or 3 years. But if you're an applicant, how on earth do you make a choice about a course and its breadth of modules or the services on offer in a university or whatever? How do you make any of these choices when it's pretty clear now that everybody is under pressure to kind of save?
Yep, it is going to be difficult. It's interesting. I mean, I sort of think this is something, and it came out reading the impact assessments that were published this week. Like, you know, DfE doesn't really think that there is good evidence around what's motivating students to choose certain courses or whether to apply for university at all. And I think this is a bit of a problem. I think it would be really helpful if there was, you know, good, proper, rigorous research around, you know, how much are students concerned about, you know, these things? How much is it shaping their choices? Is it putting them off attending university? I mean, we get sort of, you know, like somebody asks Savanta to poll 1,000 students and they go, yeah, we're a bit worried or something. You know, but there's not sort of the proper depth of research. I mean, we sort of saw it in quite a few things of the impact assessment where, you know, DfE just says, you know, we're not really sure how debt-averse students are. The things they were citing were quite old. And the same, I think, could be said also for stuff about, you know, how much students are aware of, informed by, and influenced by, you know, the things about sort of the risks of university failure, the risk of certain courses having provision setback. You know, are we confident that students are really clear about what they're signing up for? Or, you know, my sense is that students are, you know, prospective students are not really thinking, okay, you know, this university is in more financial trouble than this one. But it could be that that is already feeding through a bit. Certainly for the university point of view, as you've said, it's very hard to know what to do from a sort of consumer rights perspective, because you can't just start, you know, being brutally honest and saying, you know, this course is great, but there's a possibility that it might get cut in 2 years because, you know, we've cut other courses. We don't think we will, but we might. You can't say that to actors.
The library's open for 24 hours today, but who knows?
I think it's not just, you know, our students seeing the headlines or prospective students seeing the headlines and worrying about whether the institution they want to study at will go bust. We have to also think who else is reading those headlines. I was speaking to someone in a major bank the other day who lends a lot of money to the university sector. And one of the difficulties is that their board members pick up and read the Times and, you know, so on, and see these headlines about, you know, universities are about to go bust, or, you know, universities are too woke and so on. So much negative rhetoric around the sector. And they turn around and say, well, why are we lending so much? You know, is this a kind of correct business decision? And if it does end up that, you know, banks get cold feet and are less willing to lend or give harsher terms on what they do lend, you may end up with some kind of death spiral where institutions are struggling more, they need to borrow more, but they can't borrow more. And so fighting that kind of negative rhetoric around HE is an issue not just for prospective students, but also for banks and so on, any kind of major stakeholders within the sector.
Yes, I mean, I think this, I mean, I guess on one level, Ben, you know, the sort of determination of the state to never look like it has a kind of plan for how much HE there will be, where it will be, who it will be for, and so on, doesn't half upset people like kind of, you know, banks and all sorts of other people who just broadly want to know where things will be perhaps in 3 years or 4 years. We seem determined somehow to not even want to predict that, let alone pull levers to try and make something happen in terms of where we would like higher education provision to be. We just get that same answer, don't we, every time from ministers, which is, well, universities are autonomous, well, you know, they have their own business models and so on. But surely a government even just lending this amount of money ought to have not just a plan for the rules, but a plan for what it wants.
I think you're right. I think there is, you know, there is this difficult question about what is the role of government in higher education, I think is ill-defined. And I'm not sure trying to find the answer to that right now is healthy, but maybe defining the parameters, you know, were there a way to say that government will try to ensure that the, you know, higher education learning opportunities will be available in a safe environment, you know, in the majority of UK towns and cities, you know, that starts to fairly safely set some parameters for expectation. And I appreciate that would need drilling down and down and down. I mean, Michael talked about kind of, you know, getting genuine data about what students' fears, expectations, anxieties are. And I think that would be healthy because I actually think there isn't much, and this is, you know, this is not evidence-led, apologies, but I think there isn't huge amounts of fear from prospective or current students that their course is going to disappear tomorrow and the institution's going to close overnight and nothing's going to be there. What I think there is fear about the Freddo's argument that every single week they'll come in and the side of the Freddo will shrunk a little tiny bit in order to try and make it fit. And they're going like, you know, like, actually, if I sign up to a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 year commitment at an institution, I kind of want to know that it's not just going to shrink week after week after week after week in order to make the sun set up.
But Michael, I guess the other thing, I mean, there was a moment when I was reading the impact assessment where I sort of fell off my chair. So there's no evidence on whether, you know, the amount of extra that students are working. It's like, there's quite a bit actually, but I guess the other thing is we got in there and we get this quite a lot, don't we? A sort of assessment of the student finance package based on whether people are going to university or not. And it sort of seems to me that, you know, you could probably halve the student finance package and there would still be very strong participation rates. The question is, what kind of participation is it, surely?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I was getting at before about this thing about, you know, they're very clear from their point of view, they don't necessarily see the evidence for, you know, if maintenance doesn't go up, but also, you know, if fees rise and things like that, how that translates into the volume of applicants we get. I mean, you know, I think rightly so, to be honest. I mean, you know, there's been lots of changes to student finance over the last decade, which you could argue, you know, should, you know, so things like the removal of maintenance grants and things like that, we might talk about later. You should argue should have an impact on application rates among disadvantaged students, and they haven't really. And that seems like the kind of policy issue that DfE is live to, much more than, as you say, what the actual experience is as students get there. I mean, you know, but it's how the whole system has sort of been set up in, you know, it's to measure things like outcomes as opposed to, you know, the experience beyond satisfaction, you know, things like sort of engagement with studies, you know, the idea that sort of either government or regulator takes a deep interest in that or, you know, makes big policy decisions involving lots of money on that is not really where we are. You know, maybe it's where we should be.
Danny, just before we kind of finish on this, indulge me in a bit of class war for a moment. If you're a kind of, you know, pretty well off family and perhaps notwithstanding the VAT on private schools thing, you put your kids to private school. And because the headline undergraduate fee is kind of almost in perpetuity frozen, or at least, you know, close to frozen, actually sending your kids off to the Russell Group becomes really cheap over time. And even if then you're in the kind of next bracket down and you take out a loan, thanks to the last government, you got a big graduate tax cut because you're not paying interest above inflation on that loan. Is there a moment where Labour says, well, hold on, you know, we don't really do class war. We're not a Corbyn government, but the rich are really getting a very good, the rich and the kind of moderately rich are getting a really good deal here. And we need to reverse a little bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really difficult because essentially the system we've got at the moment is, it looks like a tax, it smells like a tax, but if you're rich, you don't have to pay the tax because you can just pay it up front. And as you mentioned, Jim, you know, for some parents, that will be less than they're spending on kind kind of public compulsory education. The other issue that we have here is that, and this was kind of covered in the article on Wonky, is that because of fiscal drag, you have a situation where parents who are spending far more on private school, you know, see this as kind of a cheap opportunity for their children. But then you also have families who have less and less money, who are deeper in poverty, expecting to contribute where previously they wouldn't have been expecting to contribute to the cost of their child's higher education. And so I think it's difficult, but also we have to recognize that if we look compared to other countries, we do still have it better. You know, we don't have a time-based repayment system like in the US and like in many countries where graduates can face bankruptcy from not paying student loans. In theory, no one should be paying more than they can afford. So there are some good things about the system that we would want to protect, for example, that it's income contingent. But it's certainly not, I don't think, the ideal system for students or for their families.
Well, fascinating stuff, all of that. We'll obviously keep an eye on, and we'll probably overanalyze every little bit of commentary we get from ministers or those around in the months to come as the spending review continues. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi everyone, I'm Professor Henrietta O'Connor, Provost and Deputy Vice-Chancellor at the University of Leicester. This week on Wonky, I've been blogging about something I think is so important, rethinking how we approach international partnerships in higher education. Right now, with the Labour government asking universities to play a key role in international soft power, we've got a real responsibility to lead by example. But let's be honest, traditionally the sector's focus has been too much on student recruitment and income generation. That's outdated and even colonial, and it's time for a change. In my blog, I talk about a new model of partnership based on shared values, knowledge exchange, and equity. Partnerships should make a real world difference, solving global challenges in collaboration with industry. Here in Leicester, we've been working with Apollo Hospitals Group in India, and it's all about using big data to transform healthcare. Our partnership builds on Leicester's strong cultural connections with India and spans education, research, and clinical practice, even helping to address NHS skills shortages. It's a new approach to international collaboration, and I hope it inspires others to rethink how we work together globally.
UK Visas and Immigration, UKVI to you and me, has confirmed its remote delivery policy this week. Ben, what's going on here?
Yeah, so in the same week that the Secretary of State for Education, Bridget Phillipson, took the opportunity to tell international students around the world that if you meet the criteria for coming, for entering a British university and for entering the UK on a student visa, we will be delighted to welcome you to our country. And she talked up the quality of UK higher education. But we also here in the same week that, yes, UKVI has been tinkering around with how they tighten up attendance monitoring of international students. UKVI confirmed that its remote delivery policy for international students in HE, which follows a consultation over the last year, originally all international student teaching had to be in person. That was then relaxed quite significantly during the pandemic. And since the pandemic, it's been a bit of an open question. Under the new rules, institutions will be allowed to deliver up to 20% of the taught elements of any degree level and above remotely. That's designed as a requirement for international students, but it's hard to see how you would make the distinction between home and overseas students on the same course. You'll then be able to go up to 40% remote delivery via application to UKVI with reference to educational quality requirements. This brings the target date for implementation, although a bit ambiguous about exactly when, and there's a commitment to review that policy a year later. But what we know for now is that institutions will have to prepare to update any academic engagement policy if and where they are using remote delivery for a proportion of their teaching. And it may also need to consider things like available teaching space, module choice and design, timetable reform, and a whole bunch more.
Yes. Now, Danny, you're a former student from Cambridge. And I assume that there are still, I don't know whether these tales are true, kind of tales of students who literally never attend anything and then sort of cram for their finals and then pass. Now, that presumably under these rules will just be banned.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. When I was at university, I wasn't kind of aware of any type of attendance policy. The way that I saw it was you kind of harm yourself if you don't attend, but there's no one standing there, you know, forcing you to come in. You're an adult, you can make your own decisions. That gets much more tricky when we're thinking about visas, but also when we're thinking about kind of the value that students are getting from the money that the government government is loaning them to study, if that makes sense, and whether that money is kind of being used efficiently if students are kind of not attending properly. But I think that this speaks to some kind of really wider interesting questions that's kind of broader than just visa requirements and requirements of universities to report the type of engagement from international students. But there's some interesting questions around kind of how we define and measure attendance and engagement and whether that's consistent to how UKBI is viewing it. Questions about kind of how many hours per week should a full-time student be formally taught? You know, what does that represent? And so on. I think it also relates to, you know, we've been hearing a lot over the last few months about, or the last few years really, about kind of a mass attendance crisis in schools. But that conversation hasn't really transferred hugely to talk about universities. I think this is partly because providers, they self-assure their own data on student attendance. So we don't really have a good picture on what's going on, apart from, as you mentioned, Jim, this idea that some students just, you know, the lecturer wouldn't even recognize them, but they still managed to graduate with a first or 2-1. But I think we have to also assume that there is an attendance crisis in HE if there's one in schools. Otherwise, we're saying, you know, there's loads of kids that aren't going into school, but the moment they turn 18, if they go to uni, they're suddenly running to go to the lecture hall, which doesn't seem super likely to me. So, you know, I think it raises lots of interesting questions. And for me, I would like to see better data on who is attending university and when, and for what type of activity.
Michael, one of the devils in the detail here is the definitions, isn't it? Because this isn't, you know, an hour of teaching that is designed to be in person versus an hour of teaching that's designed to be remote. This is an hour of teaching you have to come in for versus an hour of teaching where that's either designed to be remote or is kind of optional in terms of your attendance, perhaps the lectures being recorded and so on. And then in the other bit of the detail in there is that they're saying that when they make the calculation, or when universities make the calculation across a course, you have to sort of assume that anything that's optional, a student will opt to not come in for. Now, it seems to me that that, if nothing else, disincentivizes universities from putting on extra, you know, kind of Zoom webinars on catching up on your teaching or whatever that end up in your timetable. It sort of really disincentivizes kind of extra stuff that a university might put on that might be very useful for a student who struggles to get to campus.
Yeah, it does seem to. I mean, it's hard to know quite how sort of rigorously this will be enforced in practice. And, you know, I know there's some in the sector who think, you know, keeping a little sort of vagueness and or flexibility in the policy is probably in universities' interests through their discussions with UKVI. I mean, it is interesting, especially as you say, given all the sort of advances in online or sort of, you know, digitally enhanced teaching that there's been, especially since the pandemic, and just, you know, generally, that a lot of these things which are innovations and which in some cases have been invested in, both, you know, especially in staff time, but also, you know, financially by institutions to do really innovative things, are all sort of, you know, potentially complicated by this. I mean, it's very notable that when the Office for Students looked into this in England, you know, they were sort of bounced into it a bit by sort of, you know, a couple of years ago, lots of sort of stories about, oh, students are all online, you know, universities are just, you know, they don't want to go back to in-person teaching. You're just paying £9,000 to sit on Zoom and et cetera, et cetera. And they did this blended learning review, and they didn't come down with anything as sort of a dogmatic as this about saying X percent this or, you know, Y percent if you can fulfill these criteria. You know, they actually did quite a sort of, you know, sensible and interesting sort of set of guidelines and sort of looked at how they related to things like the B conditions. You know, I think what we've got here that I think is proof, if, you know, further proof, if anyone was in any doubts, that, you know, the Home Office and UKVI really do, you know, in the policies they implement and how they implement them and how rigorously they pay attention to what they're doing, does really shape how students are taught, you know, and contribute quite fundamentally to the nature of education in universities, you know, which is inevitable given how big, you know, how much the government has gone down the road of paying for the sector via international fees, you know, and with the sorts of knock-on effects on student numbers, you know, and how much individual universities have really leaned into this, you know. But I think this, the role of the Home Office and UKVI in shaping the educational side of the university, you know, even though in the consultation they said, oh yeah, this is not an education policy. It is an education.
This is not an education. We promise.
Yeah, but there's, you know, I think it's something that's not pointed out enough.
Ben, I guess the other thing for me is, I was looking at this and thinking, okay, so the standard is 2080, and if you make a special application course by course to UKVI, you can shift it to 40, 60. But I was thinking to myself, if you're a university thinking about, you know, saying to UKVI, here's six courses that we want to be 40, 60. One, you get extra scrutiny from UKVI. But two, who are the international students that are selecting providers who think, oh yeah, I definitely want to move to that country and then only have 60% of my teaching in person? You know, there aren't many incentives here for that sort of 60-40 policy, are there?
I don't know. Look, the honest truth is, so I keep thinking about my daughter who's at secondary school. I'm interested in how she is, what she is learning, how she's learning, how she's developing. I don't really care. I don't learn that by focusing on her attendance rates and the mixture of delivery of learning. I focus it by listening to her and how she feels, and is she happy, and is she developing into a great person, and so on and so on. And interestingly, she probably wouldn't be desperate to be at school 100% of the day either. I think we're maybe focusing on the wrong thing.
Hold on. That's your daughter presumably choosing universities in this country. I guess my point is, if the cost was like double and she was thinking of leaving the country to go to another country, wouldn't comparing two courses where one of them, you know, 40% of your teaching is online, wouldn't that affect her decision?
I don't know. Maybe when she's living in a different country as part of her education, she's spending time socializing with different people in different places and exploring that country widely and so on and so on. That's all part of her personal development and this rich, wonderful experience that she's getting. But you know, and ultimately, if I was the parent who was paying the bill for that, I'd be going, are you happy? Are you healthy? Are you safe? Are you learning? Are you developing? Are you developing a network of friends and different cultural influences? I wouldn't be going, how many Zoom lectures did you have?
Yeah, I guess it depends on, to some extent, what kind of experience, you know, applicants had in that kind of, you know, heavy Zoom teaching period, both in schools and in, you know, in other providers back in the pandemic. But I guess, the other thing, Danny, here is that, you know, this is clearly driven by a set of either real or at least political concerns about students appearing in the country only to work and then never really manifesting, you know, and perhaps in some cases disappearing. You know, a lot of this is about, you know, to be fair, it isn't an education policy. This is an immigration policy, isn't it? About, you know, the Home Office assuring its ministers and the public that international students are students.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult one. I think that a lot of the rhetoric around international students from the media and online, etc., is unhelpful. And if you've ever worked in university or visited one, you'll know that there are, you know, the majority of all students that are home and international students are, you know, enjoying learning and wanting to learn and wanting to, you know, invest in a better future for themselves. I think on the other hand, at SMF, we published a piece by one of my colleagues, Jonathan, a couple months ago about, you know, the MERC and the sector's response to concerns about international students. And one of the points that he makes is that at times the sector has been extremely defensive when there have been concerns about international students, how many we have, what they're doing, how much they're learning, their motivations, etc. And that has, he says, kind of eroded or contributed to a reduction in public trust and to universities and international students. And so, look, we've got a huge sector. We've got loads of international students coming to study in this country. It is true that there will always be in that system some, you know, ghost students that come over and, you know, they just want to work and they're not engaging in study in the way that we would envision it. But as we said earlier, that's the same for home students, who some of them will definitely be going to university and attending, you know, very little. And so I do think that this represents kind of a broader concern about international students, the extent to which the sector relies on them, the extent to which that's regulated and enforced and so on. But, you know, the challenges are no different for home students either. It's just kind of how we talk about it.
And Michael, just before we come off this, just give us an update on where we are on, you know, partly, I guess, in terms of the kind of gossip that slides into our DMs, but also the sort of above the surface official stuff on what we kind of know about UKVI enforcement, because there's some stuff going on with the register of providers, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, this thing about the attendance policy was sort of, in a way, rolled into the MAC review response. I mean, the Home Office sort of said, you know, once the MAC review concluded, they kept the graduate route, but they said, oh, you know, we're cracking down on attendance and we're smashing English and we're, you know, and then you looked at the actual policy details and it was like, okay, we're continuing to implement the ongoing UKVI remote delivery policy and we're, you know, engaging in a, you know, conversation with the sector about English. But, you know, there are still things going on which, you know, they're not as sort of draconian as they could have been. But, you know, there's a Home Office review of English language levels. There is sort of, you know, ongoing work from UKVI, which you've mentioned, especially about sort of compliance generally. So that's how universities, as you know, institutions that have permission to recruit students, how well they're complying with UKVI rules. And you know, they said they were going to make some tweaks to things like the, you know, the levels of completion and continuation and things like that that they were interested in. And as you mentioned, one of the things they've done is they've started, you know, not in any particularly sort of transparent name or shame way, but they have started putting up a list which is updated once a day, saying, you know, which universities are, you know, registered student sponsors. But also there's a little column where it says, okay, and these ones are subject to an action plan. And there's about, I think there's about 8 at the moment. So not all of them are universities. Some of them are sort of language schools and things like that. And it's, you know, it's very unclear for what reason they've been put on an action plan, that, you know, UKVI won't comment to us, the institutions won't comment to us. And it's all supposed to be quite hush hush, but you know, there is a little bit more monitoring going on. You know, people will be looking at these rules around remote delivery and thinking, okay, this isn't something we probably can just fudge. It is something where, you know, these demands for compliance with visa policy and visa rules are, you know, only going to sort of strengthen and strengthen, especially when there's always the risk that there's another big media storm about, you know, students' English language requirements or the number of students switching off study visas and doing things like claiming asylum. Like all these things are going to, you know, flare up again in the tabloids, and the Home Office, whoever the government is, are I think pretty dedicated to saying, here's all the things we're doing, here's all the ways we're acting.
So now more transparency over whether or not a university's under an action plan for immigration than there is an action plan for their finances from OFS. But yeah, we are where we are now. Great stuff. More on the site, obviously, about all of that. Now, let's go across to me, pre-recorded, talking about an exciting event coming up in March. Hello, it's Jim from the team here with news of our exciting student experience event in March. UKHE has a great reputation, but as the resource envelope tightens, it's not clear that what's been sold to students as a higher education experience can compensate for high costs, overcrowded facilities, and stressed out academic and support staff. The result? Widespread health and wellbeing issues, stubborn awarding gaps, and the erosion of opportunity as demand for higher education begins to slip. Some say the future lies in a great unbundling, but in truth, reports of the death of the full-time 3-year degree have probably been greatly exaggerated. So with a new government, a renewed commitment to access and student success, and a regional regeneration agenda, there's an opportunity to build a different vision for a full-time student experience that acknowledges that students are citizens too. They're passengers, clients, patients, employees, voters, parents, volunteers, and taxpayers, each with their own distinct needs and future potential. So as our unique student experience event returns for its 7th year, we'll try to climb out of the doldrums over the student experience debate, asking the question, what would it take for the UK to offer the world's best student experience? We'll get beyond trying to discern the student interest and work towards an ambitious, positive vision for students' participation in higher education. We'll also spend some time interrogating some of the wicked problems associated with particular groups of students in HE. Disabled students, PGR students, students who live locally or less locally to their campus, and the students whose work-based learning means that even the word student, let alone the policy surrounding them, can seem alien. On the day, we'll round up key findings into the student experience from the past year and launch exciting new findings on the student experience beyond the classroom. It's the essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's the secret life of students at the Shaw Theatre in London on the 18th of March. We can't wait to see you there. Tickets and more details on wonky.com. Now, various things going on in Scotland this week. Wonky's editor Debbie McVitie has the details.
Cast your mind back to the summer of 2023 when, in his independent review of the skills delivery landscape in Scotland, James Withers concluded that landscape was all a bit incoherent. At the heart of the problem is 3 different agencies with responsibility for funding universities, colleges, training and apprenticeships, and students. So you've got the Scottish Funding Council, you've got Skills Development Scotland, which focuses on that apprenticeships and training element, and the Student Awards Agency Scotland, which is responsible for student funding. Now, the Scottish Government has made some proposals about how it wants the system to work in the future, and this will all be encoded in legislation in the following weeks and months. So the Scottish Funding Council is to be given responsibility for all of the funding that currently sits to Skills Development Scotland. So it will now be responsible for funding universities, colleges, and apprenticeships and training provision. The Student Awards Agency Scotland will take further education student support away from the Scottish Funding Council, so it will be responsible for student support for both further and higher education. Skills Development Scotland will still exist, but it will be primarily focused on the provision of careers information and guidance. So we'll still have three agencies, but their responsibilities will be arguably a little bit more streamlined. All of this legislation is coming shortly. The thing that's, I think, quite interesting for higher education to consider is there's an open discussion about whether the powers of the Scottish Funding Council should be strengthened in some way, particularly in light of some of the financial challenges that Scottish institutions are facing. Now, University of Scotland has very consistently said university autonomy is absolutely paramount, and certainly I think the sector is unlikely to endorse a significant change in the Scottish Funding Council's powers, but keep an eye out for that debate to continue to rumble on.
Now, finally this week, Black Bullion has released its annual Student Money and Wellbeing Report. Danny, I'm assuming this is bad news.
Yeah, wow. Mixed news, really. Hot off the press, this report's come out this week and it's based on a survey of 1,500 home students. There's lots to dig into. It's, you know, quite a comprehensive report. But some of the headlines were 77% of respondents reported a negative impact on their mental health due to their finances. 57% reported experiencing feeling too hungry or cold to study. So that's obviously, you know, but that's obviously concerning. But in some promising news, the gap between how much students say that they need and how much they actually have fell from the previous survey, from more than £600 to £350. I will note that it's small sample size, and as far as I could see in the report, it doesn't say whether the results are weighted or representative. So I'd take this as directional rather than an absolute number, but it's positive to see it falling, and it seems to track with inflation over the years as well. But what I think is the most interesting bit from the report, and this is covered by Lee Elliott Major, who's an academic at Exeter and Wonky, is how they looked into the experiences of students who had been eligible for free school meals, which is quite a good indicator of poverty. And the levels of hardship in this group is much higher, whilst at the same time, the number of pupils eligible for free school meals has substantially increased in the last few years because of rising levels of poverty. And I think that this raises some interesting questions about whether, if we're looking at university from a social mobility perspective, whether looking at access is sufficient. You know, for example, is bringing loads of poor students into institutions where, you know, if we take this survey at face value, they'll have worse outcomes and they'll be hungry and they'll be cold. Is that kind of a measure of success for us? And if not, what can the sector and government do to address that issue?
I mean, Ben, I think the other cracking point, of course, that Lee Elliott Major makes is that there have been at least some people celebrating that, you know, there's a record number of free school meal pupils in HE without saying or noticing that there's a record number of free school meal pupils in general. You know, that population is growing and potentially a smaller percentage of that population is getting into university, even though the overall numbers are higher. But this thing about differential experience is here in this study as much as it's in that debate about fees and finance in general, isn't it?
When I read some of the report, I think the thing that struck me is this recurring fear I've got that as a society, whether we're talking about students themselves, students' unions, universities, government, you know, whoever it is, that we are servicing the problem rather than solving the problem. So there, you know, and some more than others, I might add, but you know, so there are initiatives of, you know, an increase in food banks. There are initiatives like subsidized baked beans in student union bars. There are all these initiatives, both in general society and on campuses, that service and, you know, try to stick a sticking plaster on students living in poverty. But I just can't see the strategy to try and solve it. The levels of poverty are growing, and just sticking sticking plasters on it and asking students to, you know, toughen up a little bit and learn to cope with it better. You know, maybe they are doing, but I'm not sure that's a long term and you know, great solution.
Yeah. So I think the other interesting thing, I mean, so what Lee Elliott Major says is that, you know, this, you know, the stats here and what we know more generally about the experiences of students from disadvantaged backgrounds at university are, you know, the clearest policy response to that would be the reintroduction of maintenance grants for these students. You know, he says it should be an immediate priority for Labour. And I think on the surface, that sort of feels true. You know, Labour surely is interested in these students, is interested in incentivizing their study, you know, but I'm not really sure that the case is made made. I think, in fact, I'd go a bit further than that. And I think I do not see maintenance grants now coming back in. I mean, we've talked about this before on the podcast. Well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, there's been changes to the debt rules, which make sort of direct spending on maintenance grants much worse for the sort of overall public finances and Rachel Reeves' golden rules than, say, for example, doing a good, healthy increase to maintenance loans. Also, as I said before, in evidence terms, it seems like DfE doesn't hugely believe that maintenance, the absence of maintenance grants is putting off students. And also, I just don't think people are really making the case for it to government behind the scenes. I mean, you know, publicly, lots of people would agree maintenance grants, but I really don't think that, you know, universities, representative bodies, staff, trade unions, when they're talking to the government now, are saying, if you can free up a couple of billion pounds, or, you know, maybe a little bit more than that, then this is where you should invest it in the HE system. I think people are making the case that it should come to institutions much more than it should go to students. I also don't know whether it would, you know, would it really be the best way to sort of, you know, cut the debt that students graduate with, as opposed to putting more money in their pockets now, or, you know, or doing something even better than that. I appreciate where Lee is coming from, but I'm pretty pessimistic that maintenance grants are on the policy agenda for the next few years.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Ben, Danny, Michael, Salmon, who also makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.